Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, a month after the Erskine fire devastated communities around Lake Isabella, residents there are left asking, where's the help from FEMA? We'll talk to Lois Henry of the Bakersfield Californian and get to the bottom of why a disaster declaration from the federal government hasn't been forthcoming. We'll also find out why the surfing world has its eyes on a place far away from the ocean, a place in the middle of the Central Valley. It's all part of the decades-long quest to find the perfect wave. Plus, U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera joins us to talk about his second term as the nation's chief poet. That's all coming up later in our program. Right now, though, we turn our attention to public safety. Relations between communities in the Central Valley and police departments seem to be at a boiling point. Protests and counter-protests have taken place several times this summer in Fresno, Bakersfield, and other communities. The Fresno Police Department has an independent auditor who's supposed to keep an objective set of eyes on the department and help build community trust in policing. But as Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports, some are questioning if that position is getting the job done.
For about the last 6 years, Fresno's independent police auditor has been reviewing police-involved shootings and other excessive use of force complaints. But with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, the addition of police-worn body cameras, and heightened scrutiny on officer behavior, some are questioning if his role should be expanded. Richard Gomez is with the Fresno Center for Nonviolence. He says the auditor has not had the impact promised because his authority is too limited. For example, lacking the power to issue his own subpoenas or do his own investigations.
They need to take the chains off him, allow him to do the job, allow him to investigate, so that he can do his job better. Right now, he's looking over paperwork.
Currently, the auditor, Rick Rasmussen, reviews the cases at his home in Salt Lake City. He does not conduct his own investigation. Instead, he examines the results of FPD's internal affairs report to determine if a shooting followed policy. He also double-checks citizen complaints about mistreatment, profiling, and use of force. But again, he does not talk to the officers or witnesses in either case. It's not just community activists that are raising the possibility of reviewing the role of the auditor. It's now an issue in the Fresno mayoral race. Fresno County Supervisor and mayoral candidate Henry Perea agrees that it may be time to reassess the role and scope of the auditor.
In my mind, having a part-time auditor that lives in another state, that doesn't cut it for me. Okay, how can you possibly be engaged in what's happening in this community if you're part-time and you live somewhere else? So I would change that dynamic immediately.
Perea says that as Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer nears retirement age, voters need to consider the direction of the department because the next mayor will likely appoint his replacement. For his part, Dyer believes the current arrangement has been helpful to the department. He's opposed to expanding the oversight power of the police auditor, especially when it comes to granting the position subpoena power.
We have a number of other people within the criminal justice system that have that authority, the district attorney's office, the grand jury, the FBI, the state attorney general's office, and I think that's where those powers should be reserved for.
Dyer says he thinks the auditor has been effective, putting an extra set of eyes on the department and making sure policies are up to current standards. Fresno City Council member and mayoral candidate Lee Brand was on the council when the position was initially established. He supported an auditor at the time and says he's okay with how the position has played out.
Provides a degree of independence and other changes like body cameras and an aggressive effort by our new district attorney to follow up on things. I think, at least at this point in time, I'm comfortable with what we have now, the model we're using.
And even those highly critical of the police have given the auditor some credit for bringing hard-to-find information, such as racial data on police detentions, into the public and causing the police department to more closely examine its policies. And the policies are the key part, according to Auditor Rick Rasmussen. The auditor can only determine if a certain action, say an officer-involved shooting, followed the department's existing policy. but he's also in the position to try and convince the department to change those policies if they're out of date or do not function as intended.
I mean, I don't know a person that if you ask, hey, would you like a pay raise and more power, would say no to that. But for what my task is and what the community has decided their version of oversight should be, I feel that I have sufficient powers to be able to adequately oversee the police department and enact change.
Rasmussen points to the addition of body-worn cameras as one of the signs of success. He says they were among his first recommendations and have proven to be useful in reviewing police shootings. At least two officer-involved shootings have been captured by police body cameras since they began rolling out last year, including the controversial shootings of two unarmed men, Freddie Centeno and Dylan Noble. Concerns over police oversight and behavior are clearly part of the political conversation, but whether that actually influences how people vote will be made clear in November. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. Last year, a world-famous surfer announced he created the perfect man-made wave, something that people had been trying to do for decades. At this point, no one knows exactly how he did it, and the site where he built it isn't open to the public. But Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero found the wave site in the most unlikely of places.
11-time world champion surfer Kelly Slater dropped a bomb last December when he released a video of an 8-foot man-made wave in what looks like an old ski pond nowhere near an ocean.
This is our little secret spot about 110 miles from the coast.
In the video, Kelly sees the wave in its perfection for the first time.
Oh my God! No way!
Later, he surfs down this long, skinny lake on what seems like an endless, perfect wave. His friends go wild, just like the rest of the surfing community has over the last 7 months.
Seeing that, I'm 100% positive our team built the best wave that anyone's ever made. It's a freak of technology.
The video's gone viral, and in the aftermath, the wave's location was found through public permit records for a fish pond about an hour south of Fresno, right outside Lemoore. It's in the middle of the Central Valley. I'm no surfer, but my friends Graham Brock and Kyle Millward are. So we drove to Kings County to find this perfect wave.
I honestly expect to see a flat pond, but I hope to see Kelly Slater surfing it. That'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, well, let's go figure this out.
Maybe some. It'd be fun.
Here we go. We used the video to find the wave, but the property was surrounded by an 8-foot-tall fence on one side and a row of tall trees on the other.
Kyle fangirled out and took a picture already.
I did.
Of a fence. And
of a fence.
Security guard.
I was here.
Oh, you couldn't see more when
you
jump.
A little bit. There's a little hill over there.
Since we couldn't see much, we talked to neighbors. Sonia May, who lives next door, says construction on this project has been going on for 2 years.
The people that owned it originally put that lake in. They sold it and moved to New Mexico, and he drained it. It's all cement.
Oh, really?
Probably $1 million in cement.
But unlike our disappointment of not getting in, surfers from around the world have passed through the Red Gate to give the wave a go. In a new video on the Kelly Slater website, pro surfer Kieran Perro visited the site.
Coming here was a total unknown, so surprising to come and see how powerful the wave is. It's got so much push behind it, something I wasn't expecting in a wave pool kind of environment.
Perro is one of the lucky few. Other surfers like Michael Willis are interested in riding the wave.
You'd go anywhere around the world to catch a wave like that. It looks sort of like Kira, a surfing spot in Australia that peels across the beach.
Michael and his brother Milton are sort of legends in the surf world. He was a world record holder for successfully catching some of the largest waves ever surfed. He's concerned that this artificial wave may be too controlled and may lack some of the spiritual factors that surfers feel.
I like wiping out. I like getting caught inside by waves. I like losing my board and having to swim to shore. Ocean surfing is extremely difficult art to master.
Willis also wants to know how this perfect wave works. The Wave Company says a very precise geometrical object is pulled through the water, creating the wave. There's a bunch more science to it, but that info is proprietary. In that same video from earlier, pro surfer Stephanie Gilmore surfed in the murky water.
You know, you dream of this stuff as a kid. Imagine when you talk about it with your friends. Imagine if you had a wave pool and it just pumped out perfect waves all day long. And then to sit here and see it within my lifetime, it's like the coolest thing ever.
Jess Ponting, with a Center for Surf Research in San Diego, thinks the perfect wave could make Gilmore's childhood wishes come true in surf parks around the world.
Anywhere that has these installations is going to become a tourist destination in and of itself. Okay, there's one in the United Arab Emirates that's right in the middle of the desert, and it's booked out 8 months in advance.
And that's exactly what the perfect wave is going to do. The World Surf League, the governing body for professional surfers, is acquiring the rights for the perfect wave. The group CEO, Paul Speaker, says the technology will also create a new way to hold surf competitions. Imagine a perfect wave for every surfer.
We see in the future, 2 or 3 or 4 years out, that there would be a hybrid tour of ocean locations, but also complementing that with a wave pool experience and something that allows us to move into markets that maybe aren't coastal markets.
Speaker says the wave will never replace the feeling that a person gets while surfing out on the open water. But this advancement in wave technology is going to open a whole new chapter for the surf industry. The acquisition is expected to go through sometime this month. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. Last week on our show, we talked about new research that suggests the die-off of the mixed conifer forest in the Sierra, due to the drought and bark beetles, might not actually increase wildlife risk. The key point, according to those experts, is that temperature, not tree mortality, is linked to wildfire severity. We heard from a number of listeners about that story, including mountain residents who begged to differ with the findings of that analysis. One of them is Howard Hendricks. He sent us this letter. He lives in the mountains outside of Fresno. The wildfire risk deniers let dead forests stand until they burn down or fall down because it's more natural approach is most reprehensible in the way it utterly fails to take into account the potential costs in human lives. Over the last decade, more firefighters have been killed by falling trees and limbs then they have been killed by fire itself. The difficulty and dangerousness of our massive tree mortality situation for firefighters doesn't end when the trees fall down either, since those downed trees remain as jackstrawed timber so dense that not even bulldozers can plow an escape route through it in the event of fire. People who live on private land in Sierran forests, as my wife and I do, apparently do not come in contact with the wildfire risk deniers' eyes or hearts at all. We are surrounded by those trees that the risk deniers like Hansen would prefer to leave to burn or fall down until they burn or fall down on our houses. Again, a letter from Howard Hendricks, a listener responding to our piece from last week. Moving on with more news about wildfires, it was last June that the Erskine Fire devastated communities around Lake Isabella in Kern County. Nearly 300 homes were destroyed in the fast-moving blaze in communities like South Lake. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom reached out to the Federal Emergency Management Agency for help. Then late last month, FEMA released its response. They said no to a major disaster declaration and the federal help that accompanies it. That left many locals shocked and dismayed. Here to tell us more is the Bakersfield Californian's Lois Henry. Lois, welcome.
Hey, Joe.
First, before we get into the FEMA thing, about a month after the fire was contained, what's the situation like on the ground right now outside Lake Isabella?
Well, I haven't been up there in a couple of weeks, but from what I've been monitoring online, it's a whole lot of volunteer organizations working really hard to network with people and keep communications up and find ways to provide the right services to the right people at the right time. You know, when something like this happens, you know, human beings need different things all the time. And so the volunteer organizations have kind of banded together and they've created this all for one movement where one organization is trying to sort of coordinate with everybody else. You know, so one person can go to one organization and say, this is what I need. And then that organization, you know, sends out the need request and finds the order. It's kind of amazing, actually, how this community has really come together, which is unfortunately, I think, one of the things that FEMA is looking at that's penalizing it by saying, well, you have enough voluntary organizations, you don't need our help, which I think is really unfair.
Yeah. So exactly why did FEMA reject this? It seems shocking looking at this, the surface of the situation. You had so many people lose their homes. Many of them did not have insurance. This is not the most affluent community out there. Why did FEMA reject this?
Well, when I spoke with FEMA, this is another interesting thing, you know, as a journalist, and you'll understand this. It's like it's a public organization funded by public dollars, and another public entity, the state, and another public entity, the county, are trying to work with them to try to, and yet they were very cagey about how they made the decision and why and what factors were more relevant than other factors. Because there's a list of about 10 or, you know, maybe a dozen factors that FEMA is supposed to look at. One is the household threshold. You know, if more than 801 homes burn, that's an automatic. You get help. You get a disaster declaration. And in this case, it was 290 homes. And then there's, you know, if everybody involved has private insurance, then they're considered to be taken care of. And that's not the case in this situation either. And then they have other factors like special populations. If special populations are affected, and those can be poor, disabled, veterans. Well, we have a whole lot of poor, disabled, and veterans, you know, all of the above up there. And then they're supposed to consider impact on the community and the sort of the density of the destruction. Well, Southlake, almost in its entirety, was destroyed. And when you look at the area that was destroyed as a percentage of the overall population of the Kern River Valley, it's a huge impact. This is not Los Angeles. You know, I mean, 290 homes in Los Angeles would barely even register, really. Here, it is a huge percentage of the population, and it is very poor. And anyway, so when I spoke with FEMA, I really tried to pin them down on, you know, which factors played more heavily than other factors, you know, and, you know, was there some sort of formula, some sort of percentage that they would use? I thought there must be, and they just sort of kept saying, well, you know, more than 200 people have already applied for homeowner insurance, and, you know, they're getting help. And I'm like, well, yeah, that might be true, but those people might be the landlords, and because most people in Southlake were renters. So where are those renters going to go? I mean, it's just sort of on and on.
So what,
and they also said, well, we feel that the county and the state have the resources to handle this. And I said, because the county asked me, if FEMA tells you there are state resources, please ask them what resources those are, because the county was not getting that information. So I asked FEMA, what state resources are you listing as being enough to take care of this situation? And they said they couldn't tell me. And I was like, wait a minute.
As in they couldn't tell you if they didn't know, or they couldn't tell you because this is some state secret?
It turned out that it was kind of both, as it turned out. The woman's like, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, what do you mean? If you're telling me state resources were a defining factor in your denial of this declaration, I assume you have a list of actual programs and the funding available to those programs that tipped your decision. And she said, well, you know, that's just all in the state packet. It's all in the state packet, meaning the state application for aid. And I was like, well, no, Gavin Newsom in his letter says the state does not have resources to do this. She says, well, it's in their state packet. And because it's their state packet, it's not our information to release. I'm like, wait a minute. You're a public organization funded by public tax dollars. The state provided this to you as a request for public tax. Give me this information. This is a ridiculous game. Now I was mad. she wouldn't do it. She said, well, you're going to have to call, you know, Cal OES, the Office of Emergency Services. I'm like, all right, this is, you know, it was just pointless to talk to her anymore. So I called Cal OES, and the Cal OES guy was like, I mean, he was just silent on the phone for a few minutes. He was like, what? Here, and he sent me the whole packet. He was like, I'll send you everything we sent them. And sure enough, it says, the state does not have the resources to handle this. So it was just a silly game, and I got tired of it. And it's what I think it comes down to is more than 200 of the homeowners of the 290 homes did apply for insurance. They actually had homeowners insurance. I don't know how much coverage they had. I don't know if how many of them were landlords and maybe – you know, they're going to get repaid, but doesn't mean that they have to rebuild or re-rent at a price that these folks can afford. And I know that the female woman mentioned the volunteer organizations numerous times to me. So I think this community is penalized because people were responsible enough to have insurance and they are, you know, good-hearted enough to have a very strong volunteer organization safety net. And I think that's highly, highly unfair because these people also pay federal taxes. And you and I and everybody in Kern County pay federal taxes, and that money goes to FEMA for such an emergency. I mean, there is no other emergency that I can think of unless the dam broke where we would need FEMA. I mean, nobody wants FEMA because, come on, you know, hey, they're doing a heck of a job, Brownie. I mean, you know, not exactly the most organized organization, but when you need them, you need them. And it's just really frustrating that they found whatever they could to not give us a minimum of help.
Do you think there's Do you think there's any politics at play?
Many people have talked about this being a very conservative area, and maybe being backlash against Kevin McCarthy, because Kevin McCarthy has been working really hard trying to call the White House, trying to really, you know, give people an idea of what it's like. Because unless you've been to South Lake, you may not know. The pictures may not show, tell you. I mean, you can stand in the middle of South Lake and do a 360, and there's just nothing but devastation. I mean, it really looks like a bomb went off. The garden gnomes are melted, Joe. I mean, this was horrible. So a lot of people have speculated that this is sort of a, you know, the Democrats are in charge of Homeland Security at this point, which is, you know, over FEMA. But if that's the case, then shame on whoever that happened to. And I hope nothing ever happened, whoever made that decision, because if this ever happened to their hometown, you know, God forbid. Because it's just horrible. I mean, you got people with families and kids, and it's just when you start thinking of the trickle-down of the damage that's done, people are camping and they're living in their cars and they're trying to hold together families and they have nothing, literally nothing. It's like, Joe, you walked out of your office today and that was it. You have no other possessions. Zero.
So I understand there is some state aid and actually some FEMA trailers that might make their way to South Lake. What's the status of that?
Right, and that's not a structured FEMA decision. This was happenstance, and it was a lot of people that sort of just heard about it and decided, let's think out of the box and move this stuff here. So the state aid that people have access to and is extremely important for people to get this aid is that they are going out and they are, for free of charge for the residents, they are clearing away the debris. And we're talking about, you know, I mean, this is hazardous debris. And it has to be handled appropriately and carefully. And so the state is doing that. They are clearing those lots, and that is exceptionally helpful. The other thing is, in the course of all of this, you know, will FEMA give us a declaration? Won't they? Will they? Won't they? Kevin McCarthy was the one that heard about these 71 unused trailers that FEMA brought to the Valley and Butte fires last year. And by the way, the Valley fire destroyed 1,200 homes. The Butte fire destroyed 549, which was below the 800 threshold, and yet they got a FEMA disaster declaration, I'm just going to say. Anyway, so those 71 trailers were never used. They were brought out, and they were held here in case there was massive flooding that displaced more people out of the Butte fire. And that never happened, but those FEMA trailers were getting ready to be shipped back east to where they're stored. And I guess McCarthy and all of this, you know, heard about it and was like, whoa, 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 wait a minute, and, you know, informed the Cal OES, and Cal OES was like, whoa, hold on to that stuff. Let's see if we can use it for the Erskine fire victims. So it's going to be very limited, though, as to who qualifies for this, because you have to be a property owner, because the idea is they're going to bring these trailers down here. The FEMA is giving them to the state, and the state is going to give them to the property owners. So you have to be a property owner. You have to be under a certain income threshold and or disabled or veteran. I mean, there's a lot of eligibility hoops you're going to have to jump through. So it's going to help some people, and that's very nice, but it also isn't the comprehensive individual assistance that FEMA could provide. And also there is the SBA, Small Business Association Administration, Small Business Administration, did do a disaster declaration, which means they can go in and they can give low interest rate loans to people. But again, you know, those are eligibility, you know, requirements could prevent a lot of people from being able to access that. And the interest rates, when I looked at the interest rates, today's interest rates are so low. I kind of was like, I don't know if this, I would call this low interest rates, but it is some help. So those are the things that are happening. And then the volunteer organizations are really working with the county to try and, you know, get clothes and food and toiletries. I mean, people don't have hairbrushes. It just, you know, just, is amazing when you start to really think about what's going on up there.
Is the county, looking back at how this has played out, the county really prepared for a disaster like this, especially given the financial state Kern County is in right now with the massive budget cuts across the board? We've already heard evidence of the challenges that public safety is facing right now. But what about the disaster response? Is the county able to step up at this point?
Well, when I spoke with Georgiana Armstrong, she's the manager of our Office of Emergency Services here, she said the county has never faced anything like this. So I think that I think everybody was just sort of caught, like, dumbfounded as to the swiftness and the viciousness of this fire that just, you know, took everything from people overnight. I mean, it wasn't like one of these long, slow burns where people were even able to evacuate. As far as the safety response, you know, cuts are coming, like, to the fire department, but all of the stations up there were fully manned. It's just that they're very sparsely populated, and so these fire stations are, you know, out and about, and there's only three firefighters per station. So, you know, when this thing hit and the winds shifted, it was even if you'd had, like, you know, just a battalion of firefighters standing there, I don't know what they could have done, because this thing was just so everything I've heard from people is it just was like a freight train coming through.
Before we go, I want to change subjects here and go to one of your other passions, water, and something that you've been writing about lately. And in case our listeners haven't heard or haven't read one of your latest columns about water in the South Valley, there's this new planned community by the Tejon Ranch right at the base of the Grapevine. It's going to have thousands of new homes, but the big question is 12,000 new homes. The big question has been, where are they going to get the water? And I guess we found out it's essentially being bankrolled by something that happened over a decade ago, a public funding that came over a decade ago. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's almost like you need a diagram to follow this. It's the Nickel Water, and I call it the Nickel Water because it's owned by the Nickel Family LLC. The Nickels, who are direct descendants of Henry Miller, they're farmers. They own land up at the mouth of the river, and they also owned a ranch in Kings County called the Hacienda Ranch. And when the Kern River would flood, and I mean, it has to be a really high flood, they'd get a slug of water up there on the Kings River, right? So when the Lake Isabella was built in 1952, about 10 years later, George Nickel started making noise saying, hey, you know what, if you guys regulate the flow of the Kern River, I'm never going to get my, quote, right to this high flow water. And so they, you know, went back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, I'm sure there was legal wrangling back and forth, as there always is over water. And ultimately, he perfected that right. Everyone agreed that, okay, he has a right to this high flow river. And we'll give him rental storage in Lake Isabella so he can be assured to get that water when the river does flow high. And there's a calculation for how that all works out and stuff like that. So fast forward to the year 2000, and Tom Clark, who was then the head of the Kern County Water Agency, and by the way, had worked for George Nickel previously, he made a deal with George so that the Kern County Water Agency bought that right from the Nickel family to that high-flow water. And that involved giving the Nickel family $10 million, which the agency got from Proposition 13 funding, not the property tax Prop 13, but the Prop 13, which was the water reliability, safety, and quality Act that was passed by the voters in 2000. And so Kern County Water Agency actually got $13 million off of that proposition and gave $10 million to the Nickel family in order to get that hacienda right. Plus, the agency promised the Nickel family to give them 10,000 acre-feet of water come drought or wet year, no matter what, in perpetuity.
So essentially they turned a right to something that only happened in a big flood into a permanent right for a smaller amount of water that they got all the time. And then this water they're getting all the time, they're guaranteed to get. It's now
right,
winding up
every year
at Grapevine Ranch.
So they've sold that. Nickel family has sold that water piece by piece to different development, like the Newhall Ranch got a piece of it. An organization called CV Communities, which wants to build a gigantic new subdivision up by Lancaster, got a piece of it. And ultimately, Tejon Ranch got a piece of it, 6,000 acre feet, give or take. And so, the Tejon Ranch is like, oh, well, we're going to go ahead and build this 12,000 home development based on this, quote, nickel water. And to a certain extent, some people have argued to me, well, that means, because this is Kern River water, and I have a real problem with Kern River water leaving Kern County when we have, you know, our aquifer is, you know, upside down and we are screaming and yelling for water out of the Delta. It's like, why on earth would we let any Kern River, not a drop should go anywhere except right here. So some people have argued, well, that means that they're going to be keeping the water here for use in Kern County. And I guess that's true, except it's also, you know, do we really need 12,000? I have an argument against the development in the first place of, like, do we really need 12,000 homes? Where are our jobs? I mean, you know, oil is shedding jobs continually, even to this day. And then the trickle-down of layoffs in other industries is just, you know, devastating us constantly. So it's like, well, where are these 12,000 homes? Who's going to afford them? Where are we going to get the jobs? And why should we spend 6,000 acre-feet of water on new homes and parks when we can't even fill the vacancy rate we have now? So, you know, I got a little problem with it.
You can continue to read about that and other things in California's water wars in the Bakersfield, California. And Lois Henry covers that and all sorts of happenings in Kern County. She joins us today on Valley Edition talking about water and about the devastation of the Erskine Fire, the communities there, South Lake and others that were so hard hit last June by that blaze and searching for disaster assistance. Lois, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and continue on Valley Edition with U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. He'll join us and talk with Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero. That's all coming up just a little bit here on FM 89, Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera is a native of Central California. He grew up in the Valley with farm worker parents and later taught poetry at Fresno State. He recently was awarded a second term as U.S. Poet Laureate. FM 89's Ezra David Romero caught up with Herrera about what he's looking forward to in his second term and what he gleaned from his first year in the office.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. It's an honor. It's a pleasure.
Well, congratulations on this second year, this new gig. How is your project La Casa de Colores going?
Well, you know, we're about to finish it up. You know, La Casa de Colores, as you know, was on the internet. I for the Library of Congress website, and I wanted to have a forum so that everyone in the United States could enter poetry without having to go through all the weird editorial processes and steps, which, you know, we do as writers. We all do that as writers. But I really wanted to open up the scope. So it was based on a theme, for example, family, and then everybody would respond. But then you enter it, and then it goes in, and then people enter another one, and it goes in. And then I just wanted to paste them all together like an infinite stream, like an epic poem, as the themes changed every month. I think we're done with that one.
For July, you wrote World Unity Tortillas. Tell me about that.
I was encouraging people to write a poem on world unity. And I put tortillas because that's what I wanted to put, and it had a cool flavor. so people could enter, you know, World Unity, whatever, you know, World Unity sandwich, like a recipe poem with ingredients that the writer felt would be the ingredients we need for unity in the world, but in the form of a recipe poem. It's like a recipe poem, and the idea is to put ingredients. What if you were to write a recipe, what would on World Unity, whether you make a tortilla or a loaf of bread or peach jam, but if it was for World Unity, what would be the ingredients? So that's what it is. It's a poem, and it's a recipe, but the theme is World Unity.
What ingredients did you add, and what ingredients did other people add?
Mine had to do with all colors. It's called World Unity Salsa, and that's where I got the tortilla idea. But I was talking about, all people of all colors. That's where I started. And, of course, it has a lot of rhythm. It's a kind of a spoken word style, and it's musical. But then again, all people. So that's what this is. So this is what I wrote. The heat from the tortilla warms, then melts the cheese. Like the warm smile of your love melts your heart. Cilantro, tomato, and onion drip a spicy mix. A compliment to the soft and smooth, the perfect kiss.
What was the response like to World Unity Tortillas?
We had 500 poems respond. Some we had more, and some we had less. So I was looking for millions, but 500 is a good number, and 600 is a good number.
I'll read a piece of what someone wrote.
Okay.
Gratitude Tortilla, Arabs and Jews as Brothers Tortilla, Stop World Bad Behavior Tortilla, No Aggression Tortilla, Fairness Tortilla, PETA. Kind of fun.
That's a good way. I mean, imagine if we could do that tortilla. We could eat that tortilla. We'd be doing pretty good.
I'd go eat some right now.
Me too.
So you're sort of an ambassador now for Central California. Are you in essence stamping America with Fresno, Selma, and the way of life here?
That's who I am. You know, I grew up in this area, and my father worked in this area before I was born, and so did my mother and my sisters. Fresno goes way back in my family.
How does America react to your style of poetry influenced by this great valley?
Open embraces, a lot of welcoming. I get welcomed everywhere I go. A lot of people that I meet are also farm workers, and they can't believe that that I'm actually the poet laureate of the United States. And then they show me their poetry too, or they just simply walk up to me and want a picture book signed for their children, or a parent comes and wants me to present to me their son. Well, for example, and I was in Las Vegas, and the father had come up with his son, just the two of them, and he said, around 12 years old, he says, look, to his son, he says, look, I want you to meet the poet laureate of the United States. Quiero que conozcas al poeta laureado de los Estados Unidos. And the son just stood in front of me, kind of big-eyed. And I said, well, how are you? It's good to meet you. And we shook hands.
While we're on that note, how does the poetry scene stick out here in Central California, you know, compared to what you're experiencing elsewhere?
It's very big. You know, it's very big. It really stands out because everybody's talked about the Fresno School for decades. So people ask me, what's going on in Fresno? You know, we had Phil Levine, and was a poet laureate of the United States, and he got Pulitzer Prizes, and a great poet that everybody knows about, and the rest of the poets, and now you're the poet laureate of the United States. What's happening out there? Was there a magic, is it the grapes? What is it? And I said, oh, well, you know, I don't know if you've heard, but Fresno is the poetry capital of the United States. and then the audiences here in Fresno, they just got a big kick out of that. And, well, you know, we have a great tradition of poetry here.
What's the voice coming out of this area?
With Phil's great influence of really saying things that are real, you know, writing about real stuff, not just making it up or pretending you were in Oceanside in 1956, and then writing about Oceanside in 1956, and you never, ever even passed by Oceanside, and you weren't even born in the 50s, he would not, and I'm saying this very mildly, he would not appreciate that poem. So Phil encouraged a lot of us and a lot of his students to write about what's real and what they really have experienced and know about.
You know, you being the U.S. Poet Laureate means so much to the Latino Spanish-speaking community in the U.S., communities in the U.S. What are you noticing among Latino people and poets and the issues and themes coming out of that population?
You know, people are, it's a new time. You know, it's a new time. Back in, I would say, 1889, 1990, we had a few Latinas and Latinos in Master of Fine Arts programs. You could almost count them on, in your hands, not more than a handful. We had a handful, a beautiful handful. And now we're going in through this passageway. We have many, many Latinas and Latinos in Master of Fine Arts programs in creative writing, poetry, and fiction, and various genres, which is beautiful. You know, those doors have been opened, and we have opened those doors as well through, you know, through speaking up and wanting to make a difference because it's very important. So that's where that's what's going on in the institutions, a new openness and a new. You know, new participants, a lot of new Latinos and Latinas writing, and amazing, amazing books, as well, publishing as well. The publishers have also publishers sense what's going on, so the doors are open by the publishers as well. You know, Knopf, all of them, Random House and Grey Wolf and Copper Canyon and on, you know, Coffee House Press, on, the university presses. In particular, University of Arizona Press, but many, many, many.
I understand you were just in Austin, you know, at a Latino poetry conference or symposium, something like that. What did you encounter there? Give me some of the stories that you encountered from these poets.
It's a beautiful workshop, Canto Mundo, 2-day full immersion, intense, collective workshop in poetry for Latinas and Latinos. What I noticed in there by the writers, that most of them have MFAs. See, that's what's interesting. And a number of them have books. We only had a pencil, paper, a fountain pen, a Schaefer with blue ink that I liked, a leaky one, a yellow paper pad, legal size, which I enjoyed because it was yellow and I could write forever and it didn't cost that much, and each other. And whatever books we could all talk about and heard about and go grab. Nietzsche, Neruda, Eric Fromm, and the Prophet, and a great mix, you know, for example, and historical reclamation. We did hit the libraries, and we were very interested in reclaiming our histories and histories and identities. And so we just had kind of like two currents, maybe an international connection across the border with material in our own families. But now we have these new currents that I mentioned, you know. So I found that to be a very intense a set of participations and observations with this new crew of Latina and Latino writers.
Do you feel like were some of those themes like activism? Talk to me about that.
Major. I mean, it's all activism. See, the activism has continued, which is most interesting. It's continued. So the activism is even more intense than it used to be because everyone's doing activist literary projects in their schools or in their communities or in the universities. They're doing a lot of that. We didn't have much time to talk about it. I wish we would have had more time to talk about that, but it came through in conversations and in their work. So they're all activists. They're all writing with, you know, what they learned in the MFA and what they're learning on their own, and they're all bilingual, and they're all talking about their community, their home in Puerto Rico, and now in New York and Brooklyn or the Bronx, and or Santo Domingo, or here in Fresno. We had David Campos from Fresno participate in Canto Mundo, and one of the founders of Canto Mundo, Carmen Tafoya, was here in Fresno also early years. So it's a very powerful mix now that we're talking about it.
Can you give me an example of what you heard?
One of the poems was read by a young 24-year-old Puerto Rican from New York about Puerto Rico. And it was in the voice of a Puerto Rican working class. Maybe it was a brother, uncle, or a grandfather. And using the, you know, Puerto Riqueño way of talking and Puerto Riqueño Español, working class Español, with a lot of pop to it, you know, and what was going on. But I was so caught up in the performance and in the melody coming, the melodic voice style and the deep Puerto Riqueño talking style, that just what took me. So for me, it was more the language than what was being said. It was the language and the tone and the rhythms from Puerto Rico that got a hold of me. And I became aware of how beautiful Puerto Rico is just by listening to his one beautiful, deep voice, 24 years old.
So it's really about voice and, like, having these people's voices heard. Maybe they weren't heard before.
They weren't heard before. I mean, how often have we heard a Puerto Riqueño, Jíbaro-style poem told by a 24-year-old from Puerto Rico living in New York? I think the answer is going to be a small number. And so in a way, it's still the homework. It's a creative homework. But it's still our homework, is to tell our stories through the voices of our peoples and all peoples, you know, as well.
It's been a tough year. There's these mass shootings fueled by racism, these shootings of policemen, and, you know, even disasters. Are you noticing an overarching poem in America right now?
Yes, there is. You know, there is a big poem, and it's one of social response, you know, responding to the incredible conflict and pain, gun violence, quote-unquote small massacres and large-scale massacres. What do we do with that, you know? What do we do with all that bloodletting and chaos and fury that explodes when violence erupts and takes place in our communities for no reason at all in many cases? Well, why should there be reason for violence, actually? There really is no reason for it. Poets come from miles and miles away. They come from miles and miles away to listen to poetry because they feel that it's going to talk about their pain, what they're really, really interested in. And it's not personal stuff. It's not, you know, I need money poetry. It's climate control. That's what I've been seeing.
So it sounds like you're hearing this poem of, like, pain or a wound in America.
It's a pain or wound that seeks the melody of poetry to heal. Because with poetry, you know, you're using your voice. You're using that which is most precious to you, which is your real self and your heart, which you really want to give to others. You're not putting anybody down in the poem. You're kind of putting things together and trying to make sense of what's taking place, and you're trying to offer something that's going to take a step towards resolving what's something terrible that's taking place. So I see a lot of energy. I would say 110%, 125% energy directed in that, at that level. People want to say something to do something. Say something to do something about something that is almost impossible to describe. So it's almost a paradox.
So it's, in some sense, it's like there's this great pain or this great wound, and they want to write so they can create hope.
That's right. And a hope that has to tackle something so big it almost seems impossible, and yet they're doing it. And there was this boy at Cal State LA with his hand up. I said, okay, I'll point to him. I said, yes. He goes, yeah, I'd like to know how to write a story. I said to myself, I wonder what he really means by that. I said, what kind of story are you writing? So I could be, you know, give him more detail. He goes, I'm writing about children that are left behind when their parents are deported. He wanted to know how to better write that particular story. So then I invited him to come up to the front of the stage to stand next to me so that people could acknowledge him, and they all applauded for him. And I think we must have said a few more words about writing, but I really wanted to acknowledge him for being such a a good-hearted human being at the age of 11, and being so concerned about writing and valuing the power of writing, because he wanted to take care of this problem of abandoned children without a father or mother, only because they had been picked up and packed in a van and shipped away, never to come back. And he saw that as his mission as a young writer to work on.
Wow.
So I saw that as most significant, and that's what I see on the road.
Before we go, would you mind doing a little exercise with me?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Kind of like you did for this little boy. Could we write a little poem?
And we can write a little poem.
Maybe on this topic of pain in the wound we see in America at this moment.
Okay.
So if you were going to write a poem, what would it be on this topic? Maybe 4 lines, 5?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Where would you start?
I would start with the word pain, and then I would end with the word fountain.
And what elements would be between those words?
I would have pain and wound, and then I would follow with voice, and then I would follow with beauty, and I would follow with the hope that there's still something that will rise up from the self in the shape of a fountain that will quell and heal this wound.
So go ahead and read what you will.
It would be pain and wound, your voice that is still flowing, your personal fountain. That would be my short poem.
What does that mean to you?
At times we do have pain, and we also at times we have been carrying a wound from the past. But there is beauty that still flows in us, and that beauty is that fountain that we can go to heal.
So you have one more year left. What do you want to accomplish?
This next year I'm going to have another online project called Catalina Neon, The Technicolor Adventures of Catalina Neon Online. It's going to be a project that's going to be available hopefully for all school libraries, where children can write the book. I'm just going to present chapter 1, the story of Catalina Neon, who has a special power. And then chapter 2, 3, 4, and 5 are going to be written by the children with downloads by the artist, Juana Medina, a book illustrator. So there'll be downloads to work with, to paint, to color, and props to follow through on chapter 2, 3, 4, and 5. And this is for second and third graders.
Great.
So I want to encourage young people to write their storybooks and with poetry here and there.
It's great. And then your second term starts in August or September?
It starts in, September. In September, I'm back on the road, and also be working with 30 school districts in Chicago, and also opening up the Laureate Lab at Fresno State, our very own, one and only, unique in the whole wide world, Laureate Lab. It's an experimental poetry-torium. It's a place where you can paint and write on walls and wash it away on walls. It's a place where we're going to unlock the potentials of poetry through unknown experiments that are yet to be accomplished with paper, with poetry, with paint, with voice, with performance. It's where you get to mix everything up and see how far poetry can go, which is pretty far.
We've been talking with U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. He starts his second term as U.S. Poet Laureate in September. Thanks, Juan.
Thank you very much.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us a letter, an email, however you'd like to do it. Online, we are talk@kvpr.org and on Twitter @kvpr and @Valley Edition. You can also find our audio archives and our podcasts on our website at kvpr.org and subscribe. Get multimedia content and more. That's kvpr.org. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. on the web at chcf.org.